In this podcast, I'm going to talk about fire. There are many things you can say about it, many cultural, safety, social things you can say about fire, but this is going to be about the actual molecules getting together and converting fuel and oxygen into the exhaust gas. And everyone thinks it's a fairly simple reaction. In general, most people's experience of fire is having some childhood naive story. They have a fire, they thought that it may be alive, or things they picked up from in their childhood. Then they go to school and they're told it's wrong, and they're replaced with a fairly simple story from school science. In general, it's that standard fire triangle. You need oxygen, fuel and heat, add it together and you have a fire. And for most people, that's enough. They've got enough, and they go through the rest of their life thinking that's all there is to know about the actual process of fire. Now, let's think about it so far, that I have oxygen and a source of fuel. In general, it's carbon or wood, hydrocarbons, petrol, and they come together and it burns to produce water and carbon dioxide. Now you might say, look, this is unusual. I don't think that burning wood produces water because water puts out fire. But indeed it does. If you get a candle and hold a cup above it, smoke will rise up, but you'll see condensation on the inside. In fact, if you're inside and you have a gas fire, there's a real humidity problem, because for every carbon dioxide produced, there's also a water produced in general, on average. So you get really 50-50% water and 50% carbon dioxide produced. Now the water is in the form of steam, but that's still an interesting aspect. So naively, people don't think that fire produces water, but indeed it does if you go into the chemical reactions of it. So you have and yet another forms of fire. You can have metal and oxygen combining together to produce a fire. So one example of that would be magnesium. If you had a magnesium ribbon and you lit it, it will actually burn and undergo a reaction. Now even that is a slightly more complicated reaction than people normally think. It's not oxygen just getting into a metal. It actually goes in, heats up the metal, the flame heats up the metal, forms a magnesium vapor, and the vapor itself interacts and burns. That's a small aspect which increases it. One of the interesting things is that magnesium will also burn under water. So if you throw water on a magnesium fire, the magnesium likes the oxygen more than it likes the more than the water likes the oxygen. So it'll rip the oxygen out of the water, and you'll produce, if you throw water on a magnesium fire, you'll produce hydrogen. And so in general, if you spray water on a magnesium fire, it will flare up and blow. And I think the Germans were aware of this when they dropped incendiaries on London, and they decided to try and put it out with water, and that will increase or increase the strength of the fire. One of the things you can do is, obviously, if you've got a magnesium fire, you could put sand over the top. In general, that's a thing that you can do, but also sand and magnesium powder will burn. Magnesium prefers the oxygen to the silicon dioxide, and it will actually rip the oxygen away, leaving pure silicon. That's one way of getting pure silicon. It will. Another example is that you can actually put magnesium in dry ice and get it to burn the dry ice. So there's lots of reactions, but the most common reaction that we're going to look at is oxygen and fuel getting together to burn. Now, the general idea is that, oh well, I've got my oxygen, I've got my fuel, and all I have to do is heat it up enough and it will burn. And this is sort of the naive endpoint that all you have to do to understand burning at school. But there's a bit more to it. Not all flames are hot. That's an important thing to start getting your mind around. So you could get some alcohol in your pudding, so to speak, putting brandy on your pudding and light it. That is a gentle heat, and no more than a few hundred degrees, so 100 degrees where it burns at. Actors can actually put, and I don't recommend doing this, alcohol or methylated spirits on your hand and you can burn it and you will feel no heat from the actual flame. An example of a flame which is low heat, by definition almost, is say the eternal flame at war memorials. They have the gas bubbling up through the water and the flame lighting, igniting above the water. So obviously this is not in a very intense heat. So what is it about heat required to create a fire? Now one idea is that the heat gets the oxygen and the fuel and agitates it and gets it to fly very fast, and it flies very fast together, and if you scramble it together close enough, it actually reacts and burns. And what we're going to have to do here is actually step back a moment and actually look at what a hot gas looks like and what fuel looks like. Now I want to go through on several threads. One of the aspects, if you look at the fuel, is that the heat, the next thing about the heat is that it vaporizes the fuel. You can get solid fuel burning like coal, where the actual oxygen ingresses into the carbon and actually burns as a flame front into the carbon, a glowing ember, so to speak. But in general, the heat causes the fuel to vaporize and you basically get a fuel vapor fire. So when you light a match, for instance, you're actually observing a flame of match vapor and oxygen. The actual match itself doesn't burn. It actually ejects all its volatile oils in the wood, leaving a carbon residue behind. But that, the match itself, doesn't burn. If you're very lucky, you can blow on and create an ember and get the actual carbon itself to burn. That's all go in a ready colour, but the match itself doesn't burn. Similarly, a candle, the wax itself doesn't burn. The wax is vaporized by the flame front, and the fuel turns into a vapor form and enters the flame up the wick, for instance. So this is one complication that we have here of our simple upgrade from infant misconceptions to the school, we know everything. It's not the fuel burning. In general, the fuel is turned into a vapor. That's, of course, unless the fuel's already a vapor in the form of, say, natural gas. I'm breathing a bit hard here because I'm going up a hill in my cardiac rehab. So that's one aspect. I promised you a second aspect, the oxygen. Now, were it so simple that you just have oxygen like a crash car, you just increase the speed of the oxygen until it's going fast enough, it crashes in, creates a destruction effect and chemical reactions of the oxygen molecule hitting the fuel vapor molecule. So if you see a log fire, for instance, the flames are not in the log, they're in the gas above the log. So that's a, I suppose, an interesting point. It's a very interesting set to describe this because people are, you know, sort of, oh, scientists have to do observations, etc., etc. But when you actually ask teachers who have been teaching, what do you observe? They cannot actually say, I observe the flame of the log sitting above the log as if the log is producing gas. They don't say that because they're trained not to. And I suppose the tragedy is that then they go out feeling very self-satisfied and train whole cohorts of people not to observe and not to think. So just before we get into the oxygen molecules, let's look at some of the gas or some of the products of a flame. I said before, you can, if you hold a cup, say a chilled cup particularly, put a cup in the fridge for a while, have it cold and hold it above a candle, you'll see immediately the steam from the flame go into the candle. Similarly is true for a gas flame above a stove. The second aspect is carbon dioxide, but it's not always pure carbon dioxide. In fact, almost any flame which you can see is producing a substantial amount of carbon monoxide. That is not the two oxygens with it. The carbon, there's more carbon, and it just runs out of steam before it can grab sufficient oxygens, creating carbon monoxide. Now, I suppose this is important, that carbon monoxide is a very dangerous thing. It can actually poison you because the carbon monoxide is hungry for oxygen. When you breathe it in, the carbon monoxide reacts with your blood and basically shuts it down, and you die at relatively low concentrations of carbon monoxide. But the important thing is that carbon monoxide is a product of an oxygen-starved flame. And you can easily get oxygen-starved flames, say if you do things like have a poorly cleaned barbecue. I've got someone walking behind. A poorly cleaned barbecue, you'll notice that the flame will be white, produces or yellow, rather than the blue colour of properly burning flame, and there will be a cloud of soot coming out. And soot is the other sort of cousin to carbon monoxide. Soot itself is small balls of carbon atoms. They clump together in a more or less random form. When I say more or less random, each carbon is bound to each other, and it forms a small little soot ball. So you can actually see the soot as a blackish smoke sometimes. In general, if you smoke, the smoke white colour is more associated with the particle size of the smoke. So if it's a very small particle size, it'll be a bluish smoke. If it's a thicker particle size, it'll be a white smoke. Eventually, if it's thick enough again, you'll see as a black smoke. And it depends what the actual substance is creating the smoke. So it's very interesting to look at that. But the carbon soot, a sooty flame, one of the saving gases of sooty flames is that when the soot rises up sufficient to reach enough oxygen, the soot itself burns again. And so you actually get the yellowy or white high temperature burning of carbon, creating the white colour in a candle flame. So the interesting thing is that the candle flame will, coming up from the wick, there will be a jet of fuel gas which will be clear, and then that will burn quite vigorously with the oxygen, creating a blue section, inner section of the flame, and that will reach a highest temperature of maximum oxygen to fuel ratio at the very top of that blue flame. And above that, there will be insufficient oxygen. The burning will slow down, and you'll get the soot forming. Now, as this sooty flame reignites and burns as your classic white flame, So when you see a flame, a candle flame, that's carbon burning. It's other situations where you don't have the have such a nice balance that you get the dangerous carbon monoxide build up. So in a poorly maintained gas heater, you'll get insufficient oxygen entering to burn with the gas, and a small amount of carbon monoxide being produced. The important aspect of this is that in a school laboratory, you will instruct students to close the air inlets of their Bunsen burner. This will starve the flame of oxygen, and it will produce a less intense but very bright flame, which produces this soot, a very sooty flame, and we call that a safety flame. But the real aspect of this is that this safety flame is actually producing carbon monoxide. So it's a safe flame, but it's actually not the best. So that's the fuel aspect of it. But we're getting back to the idea of this oxygen. Now, one of the things is that we have a sort of very, big, we measure big statistical aspects of temperature. So if we put a thermometer on something, or put your hand in your head, we measure the average temperature of a big body, maybe your own body, putting your hand up to your head and reading it to your 32.6 degrees. The human body is rather regulated at that temperature. And I suppose there's a story behind setting the temperature for optimal burning. We actually do burn fuel, biological burning, which I'll get into. But what I want to talk about here is more free-form burning. Now, one of the points I'm going to get to is that oxygen is a whole series of molecules. And if you do a piece of oxygen and the atmospheric gases, 20% oxygen or 19% oxygen, roughly 80% nitrogen, and the remainder, 1%, is argon, another inert gas, and a very tiny fraction still, about one part in 400, I think now, in terms of a very tiny fraction is carbon dioxide. So you've got all these gas molecules, and what are these gas molecules actually physically like? I mean, yes, there is this thing you can draw in the textbook of two sort of lobes stuck together. They're mostly diatomic molecules, so you draw two little circles next to each other. But what do they actually, are they physically like if you expanded it up? Well, one of the things, if you had a giant oxygen molecule, let's say an argon monatomic atom in your hand, one of the first things you would do is you'd feel that it doesn't have a surface, so to speak, so it's sort of very furry, so to speak. But if you were to drop it, it would bounce straight up to the same height. It's super elastic. And really, these atoms are like super balls, we call them in Australia. This is highly elastic. And the reason that they're so elastic is that they've got such an elastic build in them, in terms of that the nucleus in the very centre of their electrons is spring-loaded in the centre there. And so this is an ideal bouncy form. And in fact, when you actually go full circle, the bounciness of a tennis ball relates right back to the bounciness of molecules inside. So if the molecules inside the tennis ball were hard and like sand, your tennis ball would drop to the ground and just go thud. But the entire property, the elastic property of atoms, is actually scaled up to your tennis ball, and actually is involved in the physics of why your tennis ball is bouncy. There are many aspects to modelling what's going on, but it's for sure the bounciness of your tennis ball relies on bounciness of atoms. So if you've got, say, an imaginary bottle of atoms, and you hold it in the bottle, and you shake it up, the atoms will all bounce against the wall and bounce against each other. And bouncing against the walls of the container, you can imagine it trying to blow the container apart. And that is quite true, that if you have a gas container and you heat it up, will it eventually blow that gas container apart. So this is a well-known prank. You get a carbon dioxide gas container for gassing drinks. You surround it with an incendiary device, heat it up, and the pressure will be such that it will blow, in my case, my mailbox apart. Someone put one of these gas bottle bombs in my mailbox many years ago, blew it clean apart. My sons were really excited about it and took it to school the next day. Of course, the police and everybody else wasn't really interested, because that was just something that happened. But going into it, you've got the process of shaking about, and you might naively think that if you get a container and just shake it up, all the individual atoms inside it will have the same energy. And that indeed is a pretty good estimation if you actually don't think about the atoms clumping together and exchanging energy, sometimes fairly, sometimes unfairly. And I want you to imagine the situation of a pool table, and you have your white ball, and you have a series of balls that you're billiard balls that you're going to hit. And these balls represent molecules, and you're going to be very good, and you're going to with sufficient power, the white ball hit simultaneously. Oh, say if it's a great trick shot, you'll hit three balls, and you'll have to give it a fair amount of power, and that power in that single ball will go out and hit those three balls, and those three balls will power off roughly with about a third the energy, or a third the speed. I've got to be careful on this. A third the energy between the three balls. So one ball goes up and it hits those three balls, and now, one of the things here is that if it hits the three balls, momentum and the balls are roughly the same mass. Now, the interesting thing is the mass of the white ball is a little bit less than the standard billiard ball. So when you do a trick shot, the ball, rather than absolutely stopping still — you can get to stop still if you get the speed right — but it will tend to recoil back a little bit. It's a lighter mass, but if it was the same mass, it would hit and stay absolutely dead still. But, okay, so I've got my trick shot. I'm hitting a cluster of three balls with my white ball. It will hit that and actually roll backwards, because it's hit something roughly three times its mass, or curl backwards, and it will get those three balls to roll off quite slowly, in actual fact, compared to the speed that you hit it in, into your three pockets. Now, although that's a trick shot that you've set up in an atom, where you've got billions and billions of collisions happening every second, you do have the rare occasion where you have the reverse of this happening. That is, four atoms coming together
relatively slowly and one firing off at high speed. So if you reverse that trick shot, reverse the film, it would look as though these the white ball is slowly trundling in and these other three balls trundle in and your white ball shoots off at high speed. Now, the important aspect of this is if you were looking at the speed of everything that's happening on, you've got a speed distribution here. So what happens is that the average speed before overall is the same coming in, but you can suddenly have a collision where the three of your four atoms coming together slow down and your fourth one speeds off at high speed. Now this is important in that you have got the same average speed, the same average temperature, but one of your atoms now randomly goes at absolutely breakneck speed, going off at high speed. Now this is important pieces of trying to introduce statistical mechanics without too much maths, but the importance of this is that you have, even in a low temperature gas, every once in a while high speed atoms or molecules shooting out of this high speed gas. So even if you've got a low temperature gas, there will be albeit a reduced population of molecules going at high speed hitting your fuel. So one of the, I suppose, misconceptions is that the temperature increases the overall average and causes the oxygen to speed up and hit together. But statistically, you've always got at least one or a few high-speed atoms hitting all the time. So this will cause the should cause a chemical reaction. This naive school view of you just need sufficient energy in your oxygen to hit your fuel. Now, part of the story already we know is that the that the fuel is often vaporized by the heat. So in a match or a log fire, you have to actually heat it up such that your fuel starts converting from solid to gas. It's one of those unfortunate things to get your mind around. But even still, in the case that you have some, gas coming out of your barbecue, or gas coming out of your stove, and you haven't lit it yet, there is still some oxygen molecules and some fuel molecules statistically, not a large fraction, colliding at very high speed together. And the obvious answer is that just the high temperature is not sufficient to create burning. In fact, one of the things is that in many situations you can have, say, a gas cylinder in a fire and it's heating up very greatly. It's just the flame front has to actually reach that gas. So in a fuel, say in an engine, your engine can be red hot, but it won't light until there is a spark there. So the spark is a very interesting thing that happens. So it's just not the heat and the fuel coming together. You do require a spark to create a flame front, and that flame front to maintain the fire. And so this is a more sophisticated view of what's going on. I'm going out to the National Park. There's a poor chap stuck inside. They closed the gates of the National Park, and if you're not on top of the things, you can actually be stuck inside. But getting back into it, we've got the entire thing of a spark and a flame front. So what is going on? So just to recap, the heat by itself is not sufficient because the idea of heat is it increases the speed of molecules, but there's always some very high speed molecules at low temperatures because the heat or temperature is a statistical concept. It's not an absolute concept saying that the speed is the same for all atoms. So we're going across what actually happens in a flame front. Now, the important thing here is that I want you to get the idea of a bar fight. This is a John Wayne movie, the classic westerns. Honestly, I haven't seen anything this bad for a long time, but everyone's quietly sitting around having a drink, and someone throws a punch, and someone says, "Oh, that's awful," and punches someone else, and it all breaks up, and everyone gets the furniture and starts breaking it up and standing up and behaving differently. And it's the same is true of a flame front or a spark. What happens is it actually breaks one oxygen in half, or breaks the fuel in half, and the fuel itself is turned in what's called... There are two sort of things that can happen in a fuel. One is that you can call it, the fuel has a little bit knocked off it, and it becomes a radical. So if you've got methane, which is CH4, CH3, say, minus, because there's an electron sitting with it, so that's lost an electron for associated with CH3 plus, that is a very highly unstable molecule and it will react very quickly. Now, if it happens to react with its part that's been ripped apart from it, it will go back to what it was. Now, this is very important in that molecules are being ripped apart all the time. All the time by radiation. So you may have a bottle of oxygen, but all the time, because there's radiation going through it, the oxygen's been ripped apart. And over time, your oxygen will be the same because it puts itself back together. But if it doesn't get a chance to do that, and it comes over and the oxygen, it reacts with an oxygen molecule and produces two O pluses, a fuel reacted with the oxygen and an actual spare oxygen atom. That spare oxygen atom can also be considered a radical. Now, the idea behind this, the critical thing of radicals, there's also another thing called metastable elements. So this is a radical which doesn't radiate, it sits around carrying its energy for a long time. It's stable, but it's not really stable. It's like a trap ready to go off. So you've got these radicals being produced by your flame front. Now the important thing about radicals is that when they burn against the fuel in the flame front, they actually produce more radicals. So it's your flame. The flame that you see is burning is actually not the fuel, it's not the oxygen, it's radicalized, if I can say, oxygen and fuel. Now, the important thing is that if you just have radical oxygen and radical fuel burning together, and it doesn't produce further radicals, i.e. that it just burns and the radicals disappear, the actual flame disappears. So the important thing is that the production of radicals in a flame has to be degenerative, in that the production of radicals has to be so aggressive that one reaction of a radical produces, on average, one or two, or above one more radical. So the reaction must be such, this is half reaction, so the reaction that you see on the floor, on the board, all the time, is that fuel plus oxygen produces waste products. This is more complicated than that. It has to be a reaction that radical produced somehow, plus an oxygen or a fuel, produces a end product plus one or more radicals. And that means that this reaction is like a chain reaction. It's a destructive chain reaction. You say, oh, chain reaction, that's a nuclear thing. No, but it's also true of flames. This is how flames spread. The radicalization of your fuel and your oxygen expands and expands through it. So you have to have your flame go through this radical route. Now, this entire radical route, too complicated for kids, not tell them anything about it. Let's not tell them anything about it. But if you can actually, fight a flame through three fronts, you can deny it oxygen, you can deny it heat, which is actually a mechanism that the fuel has been produced from solid to gas, so that's denying it heat is pretty much the same as denying it fuel. So one is you can physically remove the fuel, or you can inactivate the fuel by removing the heat from the fuel, which is gasifying. But there is actually a fourth way, so that's oxygen, fuel and heat, is you can actually put a fire retardant on it. And what a fire retardant does is that it gets in there and actually locks up the radicals. It doesn't have to do a big job, it just has to actually reduce the amount, tip those chemical reactions so that they're not a runaway reaction. It's actually a terminating reaction, that your reaction, the radical, burns with or reacts with the flame retardant and it's pulled out of the fire. Being pulled out of the fire, but it doesn't generate more radicals. So you've got this idea that hopefully you see flames in a different way here, rather than your original idea that the fuel itself just simply burnt, it didn't vaporize, or the oxygen just mixed with the fuel vapor and burnt. We've got a more sophisticated idea, is that the oxygen, the fuel, enters a flame front and provides a source of more radicals, and the radicals burning, the radicals react in such a way that it's a runaway reaction, and actually you're feeding the radical zone. So you put oxygen and fuel into the radical zone, and the radical zone reacts, producing more radicals ready to receive more fuel and oxygen. So that's your fire cycle. So a few things to observe here. In your match, you'll observe that the match heats up, expels vapor, and the vapor burns. You'll be able to see the different rates of burning and the different colours of flame. But also in magnesium and other metal fires, the major thing is that that metal heats up so much it turns to a gas and actually burns. So when magnesium burns, you get this magnesium heats up, turns into a gas, and this gas itself mixes with the oxygen. You don't really require, I suppose you don't require too many radicals there, but there are radicals involved in that reaction as well, because you can actually just coat something with a magnesium gas. You can actually vaporize magnesium without it necessarily catching a light. Mixing of the gas, vaporization of the gas, how magnesium produces this cloud of crystals of crystals, and actually you have magnesium oxide. If it's a pure magnesium and oxide together, that is really a gas, and actually precipitates as a cloud. So depending on how the flame is going, you'll get different particle sizes of the magnesium cloud. So if you burn it, you will create this cloud of magnesium oxide powder. So when you're actually trying to burn magnesium, observe it, its mass increase, What you have to do is actually put it in a little crucible and let the oxygen come in and actually burn the actual metal in situ without it ever catching a light. So if you heat up magnesium in a crucible at a high temperature, that will be at sufficient temperature for the actual oxygen to burn in the classic way that people write on it in the blackboards of magnesium plus oxygen goes to magnesium oxide. That simple reaction occurs if you put it in a crucible and heat it up and don't let it catch a light. If you let it catch a light, it will then turn to a vapour and move across. Another very useful experiment to do showing that oxygen and metal, actually the oxygen adds to the metal, is getting steel wool in a beaker and putting it on a set of scales. If you have an oxygen source, all the better, your lighter. As it lights, the oxygen is pulled out of the air and you can actually see the weight of oxygen increase as it glows. So that's an important thing to pick up. And it's also another important thing to, if you're looking at the way that sodium allegedly burns. Again, on the blackboard, people will say, I add my sodium to water. Sodium plus water goes to sodium hydroxide plus hydrogen. Hydrogen plus oxygen produces your flame. Well, that is true when you first put your lump of sodium in the water. It's lighter than the water. It will skip around the outside and you'll see a blue flame. So oxygen is a blue flame, but eventually the sodium will heat up so much that it will form a liquid ball inside a shell of sodium hydroxide. That's lime. This will heat up so much that it will turn to a gas, and when that sodium vapor interacts with the air, the sodium itself will burn the air and this will produce a classic explosion. The processes that people don't generally pick up in burning are gasification of a solid. That's one aspect which generally happens, and the burning happening of the intermixing gases some distance from where the fuel is. So if you ever see a log fire, you'll see that the flames are distant from it, or you're burning a hexamine tablet and cooking food in the bush. You'll see the flame is a distance from it. The second idea is the idea of radicals. So these are wounded molecules which are ready to react, are much more easy to react. And the aspect of these radicals, they are in a zone called the flame zone, and they've got the important aspect of them that the reaction involving radicals beget more radicals. So it's sort of like a disease or a population. You start off, if you can imagine, it's like possums in New Zealand. You bring a few possums over and they start invading the whole place. And so your production of radicals produces the entire flame front, which is the way that you want, say, your engine to work. You don't want your engine to suddenly violently react or knock. Your internal combustion engine requires a smooth flame front behind it. And I suppose the other final aspect of it is that there are four ways of stopping a fire. One is by removing the oxygen. Another one is removing the fuel. A third way is removing the heat, which is major function is converting the fuel into combustible form. And the fourth one is a way of stopping fire is putting in fire retardants, which then block up the radicals and shut down the flame from within. So I'm nearly through my cardiac walk, and I hope that just focusing on the science of it, rather than actually taking you through the theology and anthropology of fire, which I'll do in other episodes, is a good insight into actually what is going on. Thanks for listening. In the meantime, keep on doing science.